Good afternoon. On behalf of the Johnson Shoyama Graduate School in Regina and Saskatoon, I'd like to welcome you all to one of our regular seminars. My name is Peter Phillips. I'm a faculty member here in Saskatoon. Today I have a great privilege and a happy opportunity to welcome Eric Monpetit to come and give us a talk today on an area of his current research. Some of you may have seen his biography, but let me highlight a few points that you may not be aware of. One of the connections we have to Eric beyond his subject area is that one of his supervisors in his doctoral work was Michael Atkinson. And part of the reason he had a first appointment here, I think, is that Michael found him, reminded him that there was an opportunity here, and he came and survived a year in Saskatoon as a junior scholar. We would have kept him. We wanted to keep him. But the bright lights of Montreal pulled him back into the East. He has a PhD in Comparative and Canadian Public Policy at McMaster. His current research focuses on issues of scientific knowledge, technological governance, with a strong European, North American comparative component to it, which makes it very interesting as we get into spaces such as biotechnology, where there are differences there. He has worked on issues of experts and expert decision-making in these domains, and on the broad process of policy learning, which sometimes we learn that we don't learn. And today, in 2006, his book on misplaced trust, which distrust. Was... Distrust. Misplaced. You're right.
It's difficult to pronounce, like that title, I guess.
Your glasses there. Misplaced distrust won the American Political Science Association's Caldwell Prize for the best book in environmental politics and policy. Today, he is going to talk about magnified disagreement, cover this, the media coverage of biotechnology policy making versus its practice. Eric, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks for the invitation. I'm really happy to be back here, and I'm also very happy to have the opportunity to speak about this. It's funny because in the past, couple of months, I'm the chair of my department in Montreal, so I was the chair during that student strike, and all of a sudden, because of that, I've become a specialist of the student movement and of the student strike. So when I get invitation to speak, it's always about this, and actually Danielle insisted a lot that I speak about the students today, but I insisted that I wanted to talk about my real research, which is biotechnology policy making. So I'm very, very happy to be here and speak about that topic. This is actually what I'll be presenting. This is the first time that I present this. This is, I guess, the end of 10 years of research on biotechnology policy making. It's not the end of my research on biotechnology, but I'm moving in different directions now. I want to close that program of research, and I want to close it with a book. And so I'm almost finished writing that book. I have all the chapters written. I'm almost done with the introduction. My flight was delayed last night, so I was able to write a couple more pages. And I have the conclusion to write. But everything pretty much is there. And again, it summarizes 10 years of research. That research involved surveys. You'll see some results from surveys, actor surveys, not public opinion surveys, actor surveys. It also involves some qualitative interviews. I won't talk too much about that, but it's also going to be in the book. And also some content analysis of the media on biotechnology, and I'll be presenting some of that. And again, like that material I've used a lot in publishing articles and book chapters here and there. And as I came to an end this research program, I thought, well, now I guess I need to find some unity in all this. And what I think kind of unified that research, or at least is a big theme in all of that research, is the role of disagreement in policymaking. What does it do? Where does it come from? Things like that. And that's what the book will be talking about. Now, this is magnified disagreement is the title that I have for now. I think that I'll keep it. I think I'll keep the title. I don't know if I'll keep the subtitle, because I really think that the book will be as much about biotechnology policy as about any other sector in public policy, at least any sector that involves scientific knowledge, technical knowledge. So I really think that this is a book that is not only relevant for people interested in biotechnology policy making, but it's interesting to anyone who's interested in public policy, political science, even political communication. As you will see, there's quite a bit of a component of political communication in this. So perhaps that I'll just drop the biotechnology in the final title of the book. Well, perhaps you'll have some advice for me on this, but this is where I'm leaning towards, because I really think, again, if someone is interested in another policy domain, well, all that he or she has to do when reading the book is replace biotechnology by his or her preferred policy domain. So this is where I'm going. Now, the starting point of all this is aversion to political disagreement. Peter mentioned it in his presentation. My first book was entitled Misplaced Distrust. Misplaced Distrust. And basically, it's a book about the distrust that people have towards politics, politicians, and so on. And it's something that I've always been concerned about, like the decline of trust toward policymakers, politicians in particular. And in this, I'm moving towards, I guess, distrust or aversion even, I think, to political disagreement. When people think about political disagreement, they usually think about politicians calling each other's name or throwing names at each other. Like the You Lie episode of Barack Obama is a good example. Like, I mean, it created, I think, an image in people's mind. Like, so if someone says political disagreement, well, then the type of image that comes to mind is, you know, a congressman calling Barack Obama a liar. So that's the sort of image that comes to mind. Or this is the first time that I use that software, so I hope you won't get dizzy. It moves a lot. I'm not entirely used to how it works. But anyway, another strong image, someone throwing a shoe at George Bush. So when you're not happy with government, well, you do things, gestures, you contest government. So, I mean, this is also an image that we often associate with political disagreement, contestation of government, very strong contestation in that case. The main thing is that when you think, or when people think about political disagreement, they think about radical behaviors, about inappropriate behavior, about name calling, about throwing shoes, about things like that. So political disagreement has a very bad reputation. It's negatively perceived in the population. And I think that we should be concerned about this, basically because I think that a lot of the aversion rests on a misrepresentation of political disagreement by the media. And I really think that the reality of disagreement in the field, in real context of policymaking, is not that bad. It's certainly not as bad as suggested by the media. And that's basically the argument that I am trying to make in this book. Basically, the argument is that when people rely on the media to follow politics, it's as if they were using a magnifying glass. I mean, it makes things appear much bigger than they really are. And it's certainly the case of disagreement. Certainly that if you look at the media coverage of disagreement, the impression that you'll have is that policy communities are polarized to the extremes. I mean, the positions that are there, it's extreme positions mostly. And that those disagreements are also having very negative consequences for policy making, for policy evolution. Basically, what it does is create stalemates, stalls policy progress. So that's the type of things that you read in the media about political disagreement. And I claim that the reality is different from that. So that's the argument that I want to present in the book. And then again, I mean, it's true that my empirical field is biotechnology policymaking, but I would tend to think that it's true of most policy domains. Now, I'll begin by speaking about the media coverage of biotechnology policy. What I have done here, well, I have two different chapters, one that presents a quantitative analysis of the media coverage and one a qualitative analysis. So I'll go through this quite quickly. The quantitative analysis, basically what I've done here is take the eight most important newspapers in Canada, the US, France, and the UK. So two per country. And again, like it's the New York Times, it's the Washington Post, it's the Globe and Mail. So it's the large newspapers, the broadsheets. You would tend to think that there are newspapers that don't exaggerate all that much. So, I mean, it's kind of a conservative choice to an extent in the sense that probably that if those newspapers exaggerate the disagreement, if they magnify it, well, you would tend to think that the other newspapers, the TV outlets and so on and so forth, do even worse. So that's why I selected those eight newspapers, and I have asked students to code a number of things. But the three things that are important here are first the whether or not there's well what sorry about that. Like what I've done is also did a random selection of 200 articles in each of these newspapers. And it's a random selection of articles that deal with biotechnology policymaking, somehow. It has to deal with that. And in those articles, I've asked students to decide or, well, identify whether or not there's any mention of disagreement. So that was the first thing. The second thing, I've asked them to say, if there is disagreement, who disagrees with whom? What kind of categories of actors, basically, are involved in that disagreement? And the third thing, I asked them to code for tone. Are they talking, like the tone of disagreement, is it more negative or more positive? And the results were quite interesting of that encoding analysis. It worked really well for whether a disagreement is there or not. Like I had two coders, basically, so I was able to measure reliability. And the reliability was really high for whether there's a disagreement that's mentioned in the newspaper. For who disagrees, same thing. So reliability very hard. For tone, it was more difficult. And so I decided to complement the hand coding analysis with an automatic coding, and that's called WordScore. So I won't say too much about WordScore, except that it was very useful to identify the tone of the article, whether it's positive or negative. So the results. The mean probability of policy disagreement reported in major newspapers. The reference here is The Guardian in the UK. So you have the eight newspapers that were there. You know, I mean, it's the probability is a bit under 0.6. So there's quite a few articles that do not mention any disagreement regarding biotechnology policymaking, or they speak about biotechnology policymaking without alluding to any kind of disagreement. So that's, to me, was surprising, because we know that actors disagree. Actually, at least I knew from qualitative research that there is disagreement in that area, and one of the norm of journalism is balanced journalism, so all the perspectives should normally be presented. And again, we're talking about like high-level newspapers here, so I would have expected to have like this acknowledgement of a disagreement in the field, perhaps a bit more present. But anyhow, so it's roughly 0.6, the probability of finding disagreement. Not all that much variations from one newspaper to the next. Actually, the statistical difference between The Guardian and the others is either not there at all, or it's there for Libération, where there's more disagreement, or the Globe and Mail, where there's less. But all the other differences are not statistically significant. So not all that much difference. Again, about 0.6. Of those 0.6, well, of those articles that basically mention disagreement or allude to a disagreement, again, students had to identify who disagrees with whom, And basically, what we got is this for a result. Keep in mind, like, the most important information in that graph is the first bar. Basically, the disagreement that is most commonly mentioned in those articles is contestation of government by advocacy group. What I mean by advocacy group, I will discuss this a bit later, it's groups that basically is not industry. Groups that have a cause, basically, that try to promote a cause. And they're by far the most frequently mentioned disagreement in the media. Again, that's the information to keep in mind. Government and government disagreement, government versus government disagreement is also quite common, especially in Canadian newspapers, because there were lots of articles on the disagreement between the European Union and Canada. So that explains basically why the bar is so high there. And you would also expect, of course, to have some mention of disagreement between industry and advocacy groups. I mean, it's there as well. But again, by far, the most important disagreement that's mentioned is the contestation of government by advocacy groups. So that's the tone now, the tone of disagreement. For the tone, again, like, it's a word score analysis. And basically what the word score analysis does is compare the language used in a text. In that case, a text that's a good illustration of an article, of articles that have employ a negative tone, versus a good illustration of articles that employ a positive tone. And basically it compares all the rest of the material, the vocabulary and the rest of the material, to these two reference texts. And what I got here is basically a confirmation of what I already had gotten through hand coding. But again, I had doubts about reliability because there were important differences between my two encoders as far as tone was going. And so I used that, and I got basically the same results. And normally there's no reliability problems here when word score is involved, because it's a very systematic way of doing it. Like, you don't get, like, the two coders with their own ways of doing things. Like, it's just like one machine that does it. And what's striking is that the median level is always, no matter which newspaper, on the negative side. So basically the coverage of political disagreement is, on average, more negative than it is positive. And there's quite a bit of a difference, actually, between the positive and the negative. It's really, really more on the negative side. And there's not much of a difference between all the newspapers. The only one that's a little bit different is the New York Times. That's a little less negative than the others, but is nonetheless negative. So again, the coverage of disagreement, when disagreement is mentioned in an article, usually the article has a negative tone. So the discussion of disagreement, the mention, the words that are used to describe disagreement are negative. Now, the qualitative analysis that I have done basically provides you some examples of this negative tone or of this negative vocabulary that that is basically used. I mean, it's not something that I have done very systematically, actually. I've done the qualitative analysis for the quantitative analysis. Again, I had to do the word score analysis. I needed two reference texts, one example of positive tone and one example of negative tone, and so while doing this, like, I came up across lots of examples of positive and negative tone. In terms of negative framing, like, I have a number of examples to show here. Usually what I realized is that when the journalists frame their story very much through a selection of the quotes of the actors that they do. So it's not so much that the journalist himself or herself say disagreement is a bad thing. They rarely say that outright. Very often they will quote actors who say things that suggest that disagreement is a bad thing. And that's the type of examples that I have here. Like, for instance, in The Guardian, there's a risk that the debate would be hijacked by fundamentalists. I mean, you have a good idea here. I mean, it's very hard after reading this to think that disagreement is a good thing, right? So the type of words here is very suggestive. Figaro, Since the middle of the 1990s, the GMO debate has grown in importance with the publication of press articles, books, and reports. Far from heading toward a solution, this debate stalls in confrontation that are both passionate and sterile. Again, the choice of words here suggests that disagreement is a bad thing. The Washington Post. I won't read all this, but look towards the end. I mean, they use the word dogma to qualify the position of some of the actors in there. So, I mean, if you say that some of the actors basically will be to a dogma, well, again, it's not like a very positive way of speaking or mentioning or alluding to a disagreement. Last one. The National Post, the EU claimed that they are entitled to WTO rules to impose provisional measures because the scientific evidence about GM product is uncertain. Although the EU got plenty of help from the NGOs on this point, the scientists generally seem unconvinced. I mean, there are two things that are important here. The NGOs here, quite clearly, they're not mentioned in a positive way. But also, like the scientists, like there's a suggestion that the scientists are united, and that they have like a unified view of where government should stand towards biotechnology policy, on biotechnology policy. And that is quite interesting because it was very common in the newspaper. Like that assumption that scientists are unified, they have a single view of where of what government should do in that domain was very, very common in the newspaper articles. Now, there were examples, very few. Like I had to read a lot of articles to come up with that reference text of positive portrayals of disagreement, but there were some examples, and I have here like one good sample of this. Several participants in the discussion said that they were deeply disappointed at the failure to reach a deal, but they also emphasized that they had accomplished some important goals nonetheless. Warring parties built new relationships with one another that may lead to a compromise agreement on piecemeal issues, they said, and the group has agreed to reconvene in a year or 18 months to see if positions have shifted. So, I mean, there is clearly a way to speak about this, or to speak about disagreement in a positive way, and that's an illustration of this. But then again, this is extremely rare. Like, you don't come across that type of excerpt very frequently in the press coverage of biotechnology policymaking. So the main thing that you find in the main suggestions that you find in the press is that the policy community for biotechnology is polarized to extremes, that this polarization causes stalemate, and that the only solution to this would be to delegate basically power to scientists who are unified. So that's basically the news story or the media story of policymaking in this area. And so what I wanted to do is see whether this match reality, whether there's a difference between reality and this. And well, you already know what my conclusion is about this. Now, how do I do it? I did it through a survey of biotechnology actors. It's a survey that was conducted in four countries, so Canada, the United States, the UK, and France. All the respondents, by the way, were identified through some sort of phishing. Basically, like you ask someone whom you know who's been involved because you've seen his or her name in documents, and you ask other names and so on and so forth until you all get the same names. So basically what I did this twice, like once in 2006 and one in 2008 in the four countries, and I got like the two times a list of a bit above 2,000 names. And overall, what I got was 666 responses, which is fairly good for a survey of actors. Again, I mean, it's people who are extremely busy, and they're very difficult to convince to respond. But 666 did. Most of these people, actually, all of these people are either civil servants. Some of them are journalists, but I mean, I think two or three. So it's not very significant. I think I've got one politician, but everyone else is a civil servant, a an interest group representative and an expert scientist. And I think that it's, and when I say interest group representative, I mean, I have two categories here. One is the advocacy group that I was mentioning before. So it's the people that basically have a cause to defend. And the other one is industry, people who represent industry, basically. So they're divided in two. And I mean, Michael knows this, like I've done network policy, network studies for many years. I know that as far as policymaking is concerned, these are the important people. This is where decisions are really made. It's rarely in parliament. I mean, there's lots of work. The important work is done before, and it's done by these type of actors. So I really think that I've got a very good group of respondents here. So now, how real is the polarization over biotechnology? Well, this is what, in the survey, one of the thing that I was able to measure is the beliefs of the respondents. And I had a series of questions on the risk related to biotechnology and on the benefit. And all respondents had to identify or say whether they believe that this benefit really exists or whether this risk really exists. And so I was able basically to create some kind of a scale of belief. And the scale ranged between minus 10 and 10. And 10 would be someone who really believed that there's lots of benefits, lots of benefits, that it's all in fact beneficial, those biotechnology. And minus 10 would be someone who believes that it's all risk. And so the range is between, in fact, minus 8 and plus 8. And as you can see here, I have something very close to a normal distribution. So people have, to be sure, they disagree. I mean, this doesn't show, there would be just one bar if people didn't disagree. I mean, they're spread out across the scale, but in a normal fashion. And there's just a few people who are at the extremes, at both extremes. That's an interesting information itself, because again, if you look at the media coverage, the groups that get covered most are basically those who are on your left on the screen. So it's those who believe that it's really high risk and who contest government. I mean, they are the ones that are most frequently mentioned when it comes to disagreement in the media coverage. But they're a very small minority, again, as you can see here. Now, I've looked also at the differences between the four countries. Well, the graph on your left at the bottom, it's not the US, it's the UK. That's a mistake. I'm sorry about that. And it's the graph, actually, that comes closest to a polarization. So in the UK, the debate was perhaps a little bit more polarized than everywhere else. And those who have followed this issue very closely, I think that they can testify that, in fact, it was extremely polarized in the UK, perhaps more than anywhere else, if you look at those four countries. But everywhere else, pretty much a normal distribution. I've looked at differences between 2006 and 2008, and one interesting thing, here I have just, like, to have too many graphs here, I have merged the two North American countries and the two European countries. And what's interesting is the bottom two graphs. Like, if you look at it, there's a change between 2006 and 2008. And in fact, in the UK in 2006, it was more polarized than it was in 2008. So there was perhaps some polarization in the UK. Again, very little, but some. And it seems that over time, it has largely disappeared. There was something called GM Nation around 2006, and I think that contributed a lot to polarizing groups. And by 2008, it had pretty much gone away. So again, not all that much polarization overall. So again, this idea that the debate would be, or that the disagreement would be really polarized, I think is just doesn't match reality. Now, do actors who hold extreme position cause stalemates? Those at the extremes of my distribution, like they're a small minority, they're a small group in the policy communities, but do they cause stalemate? Again, the media does suggest that polarization does cause some stalemate. So those who have like very strong convictions that biotech is risky, or those who think that it's, do they cause stalemate? What I have done to answer that question is basically construct a measure of what I call attitudes, or a measure that allows me to identify or to distinguish between three types of attitudes. One is attitude of compromise, one is attitude of stubbornness, and one is in between the two. And basically, this measure was based on a number of questions regarding the attitude of respondents toward a large number of biotech applications, like very specific applications in biotech. And someone with an attitude of compromise is someone who wouldn't be favorable to all or unfavorable to all, but would, you know, once for one application would be favorable, for another one not favorable, and so on and so forth. So that's someone who displays what I call an attitude of compromise. Someone who displays an attitude of stubbornness is someone who say, I'm favorable to all, or I'm unfavorable to all. And the intermediate is a movement between favorable to undecided or unfavorable to undecided. And they're the largest group of people. But there's quite a few people who have an attitude of compromise. Of course, attitude of stubbornness also is quite important. And what I wanted to see here is whether those with very strong convictions, those at the extremes in my distribution of the distance of beliefs, is it those who are most likely to be stubborn or not? And so this is just a plot. Like, I've dropped the intermediate category here, attitude of compromise, attitude of stubbornness. And what I see here is that, in fact, it looks as if attitudes of compromise are more likely among the large group of people that are in the middle in the distribution of belief. And those who are most likely to be stubborn seems to be at the extremes. But it's truer for one of the extreme than the other. It seems to be that those who have very strong conviction in the risk of biotechnology are slightly more likely to be stubborn than those who have very strong conviction that biotechnology is all benefit. And so I wanted to test that, and what I did is run an order probit regression, and this is the result of a simulation coming out of that regression, and it basically confirms what I just said. If you look only at the graph on your left, so it's the probability of compromise. Like, I have not shown the result for the intermediate category because it's a flat line. So basically, what it shows is that the intermediate category is not, like, your likelihood of being in that category is not related to your belief. So that's interesting for us. What's interesting here is the probability of compromise, and here it's clearly related to your place in the distribution of belief. And quite clearly, if you believe that biotechnology is extremely risky, you're more likely, or you're less likely, to have an attitude of compromise. And if you believe that biotechnology is all benefits, very, very strong on the benefit side. So there's, in fact, if you're on that side, and again, it concerns just a few people. Most of the people are in the middle. But again, if you believe that it's all benefits, you're closer to an extent to the people in the middle than if you believe that biotechnology is extremely risky. So there's one category of actor that appears a bit more stubborn than the others. And if there's one category of actor then that's likely to cause a stalemate, it's those people who believe in, you believe very strongly in risk. But then again, like, and that's based basically on the qualitative interviews that I have done. The argument that I make in the book is that, in fact, they're not very likely to cause a stalemate, these people. Like, I've met a lot of them. I've interviewed a lot of them. And these people, it's true that they don't have an attitude of compromise. It's true that they don't want to compromise on their principle. But they don't want to have any direct influence on policy either. They don't want to access the policymaking circle, or what I call the policymaking circle. The others want. Those in the middle, basically, they know that they have to accept some compromise from their beliefs, from their convictions, because they want to be part of that policymaking circle. It's also true of those who strongly believe in benefits, true of industry. So they're willing to make some compromise because they want to be part of that policy circle. But those who believe very strongly in risk, and it's not all of them, because some of them actually are willing. I mean, it's just a probability here. Some of them are actually willing. It's a small number. And in that small number, some of them want to be in the policy circle, and they're just as likely as the others to accept compromise. But those who don't accept compromise typically are people who don't want to be in the policy circle. In fact, they're not there to have a direct influence on biotechnology policy. Their motivation is more to contest the idea of the policy circle itself. So that's why they don't want to be in. And as a result, they're not going to cause any stalemate. They're not in the policy circle. It's the policy circle that decides. They're there, they make a lot of noise, and it's perhaps to an extent normal that we see them more often in the media than anyone else, because that's what they want. They want to be in the media. They don't want to be in the circle. They want to be in the media, seen as contesting the policy circle. And so it's some sort of a self-exclusion that's not as harmful as I think the media would suggest. And to a large extent, it's even useful, because it forces the policy circle to think very hard about what it's doing before doing anything. So from my observations, I wouldn't say that these people, who again are a very small minority, are harm policymaking. It doesn't stall policymaking. It doesn't cause the stalemates that are suggested in the media. So that's I think, one of the important findings in the book. There's a lot of there's a long chapter that does discuss this politics of contestation, and it's based as much on this graph as on qualitative information that I have collected over the years. Now, do scientists disagree less? What I have done here is just take those at the extremes of the belief scale, at the two extremes of the belief scale. And if scientists were to disagree less, they would either all be on one side or not there at all, that is in the middle. If they all agree, they agree that perhaps, I don't know, risks are intermediate. I mean, there's some risk and some benefit to this, and in such a case, they wouldn't be at all on either of these two graphs. Or they agree that it's very risky, so they're all on one side, or they agree that it's very beneficial and they're all on one side. And when I look at this, well, I mean, it's not clear at all. Like, scientists are on both sides. So it looks as if, and again, it's both sides of the extreme. So there are scientists on both sides of the extreme. And again, like, the graphs make perfect sense. Like, you would expect advocacy groups to be all on one side, and that's basically what you see, and industry to be all on one side. It's also basically what you see here. But scientists, again, are divided between the two sides. If you look at this, this is another way of seeing it. This is, again, a simulation based on a regression. It's a dyad analysis. What I've done, basically, is match every respondent with every other respondent. And that allows me to calculate a difference, the mean difference in belief between categories of actors and within a category of actor. So two scientists together, like, I have all the pairs of the two scientists that you can imagine in the data set, and I look at the mean distance in belief between this group, and it gives me a mean difference in belief. And I can take every single pair of scientist and industry representative and calculate a mean as well. And so that's what you have here. And the first dot on the left is within a group of scientists, of experts. And one thing that I haven't said is that those experts, they all have, like, their main affiliation, that was the criteria so that I would classify them in the group of experts. Their main affiliation is a university. So they work with a university. So they've been involved in biotechnology policymaking, but they've been basically consulted, they've been asked to contribute by government, but they're not part of government. The civil servants are the GVT category. And well, so if you look at the first dot, like, you'll see they're basically their disagreement is within the average. And again, that graph makes perfect sense. Like you would expect, for instance, industry and advocacy group to disagree more, and in fact they do. And the difference between countries is not that big. It's basically like the patterns of disagreement from one country to the next doesn't differ all that much. So it's the same in North America and in Europe. And everywhere, scientists seem to be like in the middle. So they don't disagree significantly less than the other and not significantly more either. So that's kind of also revealing that they might not be as unified as a group as journalists seem to suggest that they are. And finally, and this is the interesting one, because those university scientists, they have all kinds of disciplinary background. And coming from a social science background, it hurts to hear that, but you know, sometimes in the natural sciences, they think that we're not real scientists. And we're not as serious and all that. And so people could have said, well, the problem with your thing is that you mix the natural scientists with the social scientists. The natural scientists, they agree more, of course, that the social scientists, they disagree. They don't do the real stuff like we do, and we're more unified as a group. So what I decided to do here is controlled for the disciplinary background of the respondents. And it's quite interesting to see that, in fact, in the sample that I have here, the experts with a natural science background, they disagree even more than the experts with a social science background. So, interesting. I mean, it's not a big difference, but there's still a difference, and the difference seems to be to the advantage of the social science more than to the natural science. So, then again, I don't think that the scientists are the response to the so-called problem of disagreement that the media point to. Now, I will conclude with some of the contributions, I think, of this book. Again, this will appear in the conclusion that has yet to be written. If I'm lucky, my flight will be delayed on the return, and perhaps I'll be able to write a bit more of this into a chapter. But I would tend to think that it makes contributions to probably three broad academic areas. The first one is in political communication. There's lots of studies in political communication that shows that the media somehow distort reality through framing or all kinds of other mechanisms. There are actually very few measures of the extent to which reality is, in fact, or the reality gets distorted by the media. And here I think that I provide some kind of a measure, and we can say from this that it distorts reality a lot. I mean, there's a huge difference between what I found in the media coverage and what I found through the survey of biotechnology actors. I don't think that the reality that they present is representative at all of the reality of policymaking in the area of biotechnology. Theories of public policy. It's interesting. Like, again, I've been studying this for a long time, and to me, what strikes me when I look at this is disagreement. Disagreement is everywhere in policymaking, but in theories, it's not all that present. When you look at various theories of policymaking, it's not all that present. It's there, to be sure. I can think of the advocacy coalition framework, for instance, that clearly featured disagreement. But in that case, I would tend to think that they exaggerate disagreement. Basically, the advocacy coalition framework does predict polarization of policy actor communities. Well, it's not what I've observed here. There's no polarization. So perhaps that there is some exaggeration there. And I would add that the advocacy coalition framework is one of the very few policymaking theory that does speak or have something to say about disagreement. Most of the others are more interested in cooperation among actors. And therefore, they kind of ignore disagreement, which I think is there, and it's a major feature, again, of policymaking. So I think that there is a contribution there. If only it is to point out the importance of disagreement and the importance of taking into account disagreement in policymaking theories. And finally, it's basically what got me started in that book. It's this idea that there is some kind of an aversion to disagreement, and it's not just an aversion to disagreement, it has really become an aversion to politics. When people think about politics, they think about disagreement and they think about it negatively. So, I mean, people have an aversion to politics, and it's in large part because I think the way the media covers disagreement, and the book might contribute to an extent to reestablish the reputation that I think politics deserve, which should be a positive reputation. So I'll stop here. Thanks.